Let's see, I'll do that a little bit better there. Gives you a little power that we don't have any people in this room. So, well, I'm going to go ahead and call the meeting of the June 6th, the Economy Commission to order. I am Chair Representative Rebecca Chalice-Help. Representative Becky Edwards, I'm sure regret she is at a conference in Denver, I believe, and will not be able to join us today. And we do have a number of other excused absences. But we do have commissioners here today, and I think representing a variety of the different committees, so I'm excited about that. And before we go further, what I do want to do is formally welcome Commissioner Leonardi and give her just a moment to introduce herself so that we can get to more of her. So the, there's a right in front of you, Commissioner, and you should be able to press it so I know which one is your mic. So just press that button there. And I will make you right, and then you can go ahead and speak into it.
All right, hello. So, I currently work for Select Health. I live way north. I live in Plain Shade. I don't know if anybody has ever heard of that. Have you? I live way north and have for a very long time. I could only reach in more than 2 decades in the healthcare industry, so we'll leave it at that. But in that time, I have worked for the Curative Site. I actually opened my own agency and operated my own shop. So I've operated everything from Medicare to individual sales, small group sales, large group sales. I then moved into consulting and worked for Mercer when the ACA kind of came into town. That changed a lot for a lot of people, changed my life as well. So I went into consulting for Mercer, spent some time there, and decided to make a change, and Select Health actually was reorganizing. And so I went back to Select Health and am the new business development for Select Health now. So have made a complete loop around. So that's kind of in a nutshell what I'm doing. Have 2 grown children. I was speaking with Kathy and have 1 who graduated from the U, and so that's kind of what I do.
Well, we welcome you.
We welcome you to the commission. Appreciate your interest and your willingness to provide service to the commission. For those who are tuning in and for those that are here, we have 2 positions on the commission. One is for companies that are larger than 500 individuals, and then one for smaller than 500 individuals employees. And Commissioner Leonardi is filling a vacancy that we've had for a while for companies or corporations of 500 work employees or larger. And then Commissioner Cragen is one for our smaller employer network group. So now we've got those slots filled. I think we're totally filled and should be good. Everybody stay in your place. and hopefully we won't be dealing with any vacancies anytime soon. So the next thing we need to do is I would like to entertain a motion to adopt the minutes of the meeting of April 4th, 2017. I was absent from that meeting, so I would like to have somebody that was present there. It looks like any, all those people that were present are here, so if we could have someone make a motion to approve those. Commissioner Cragen, yes, has made a motion to adopt the minutes. Any seconds?
Second.
And Commissioner Robinson seconds those, that motion to adopt the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, those minutes have been adopted for Tuesday, April 4th. We have with us today Dr. Sharon Mastracci, who is an associate professor from the University of Utah. And I met Professor Mastracci right as she came to Utah a couple of years ago. And she reached out to me a couple of months ago, well, before, when she was conducting her research. She sent out a survey to elected officials and folks, candidates in elected office, asking to weigh in on the survey that she put together as part of her research. And then she contacted me a month or so ago and said, I've got my findings, would love to present those to the commission. And so we are glad to have her here today. So without further ado, I'm going to turn the time over to Dr. Mastracci so that she can tell us about what she has discovered in her findings. I'll pull that mic really nicely.
Thank
Rebecca. Thank you for attending Shattuck House. To clarify, I was a, for 2016-2017, I was a faculty fellow for the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the university, and I had two projects. And one of them was, well, one was overtime, Utah overtime, over 30 years, and the other one was a cross-section of all 50 states. What I'll be reporting on today is actually the cross-section of all 50 states. I would, if I didn't get anybody, if you got my survey about Utah over time, because interestingly, there was a survey done on women in policy 30 years ago, and I'm replicating that survey and comparing, and it has to do everything with, you know, what jobs you worked in the past, how did you, who motivated you, what inspired you, what challenges are you facing, were you facing to work. I still have that data, and I haven't done anything with that data yet. So I'm still collecting. If anybody would, if anybody got the survey and hasn't responded yet, I can hunt you down. But today I'm going to report on the other project that is All Stage Over Time, looking at how women's representation in elective office affects policies for women and families at the state level. This project, these fundings are under review right now at the Journal of Women in Politics and Policy. And in terms of the title, How Women's Representation in Elective Office Affects Policy for Women and Children, the answer is that it improves, and I can show that it improves holding constant for all the other stuff that could explain how policies come into being. And I'm happy to send this to anybody who wants this PowerPoint. Okay, so without further ado, I gave away the punchline at the beginning, but yes, it does improve policy options for women and families, and this presentation is going to show you how I came to that result. Okay, so first, I want to talk a little bit about what's been found in the past and why it matters. You see a few quotes here from researchers that, as you might expect, and researchers like scholars like myself have to find this, it might seem really intuitive, but we have to study and make sure that the intuition is correct, that women legislators show a higher legislative priority on issues concerning women's rights. And then why this is important is found by other researchers in this area, that who makes public policy is important to democratic politics, and in fact, that women's representation is important to the electorate. The electorate values having a representative, like truly demographically representative, bodies as well. Interestingly, scholars for a long time used something you may have heard of, the critical mass by Cantor's Men, Women of the Corporation. That book first came out in 1977 and then a re-release came out in 1993. What Cantor found was in Men and Women of the Corporation that up until there's a 30% representation of women built by technology, because I'll tell you why it's different for women in politics, that 30% portion of women in the corporation was the tipping point where they could advocate on behalf of women. What's interesting is that for a long time we've used that critical mass ratio of 70-30 to think that that's how women in politics would make a difference after that threshold. But interestingly, when researchers look at political women specifically, they see in fact that women in vastly homogenous, male-dominated bodies actually do more than women in small percentages of the corporation. And the reason why is that in Cantor's study, it benefited women who were just a handful, if it was 10% or 20%, anything less than that 30%, to just kind of go along and blend in, and then get together once the numbers were high enough. For women in politics, in fact, being a woman was valued by the female legislators such that if there were only a handful of them, much less than the 30%, they saw their gender as being one of the reasons why they were represented, why they were elected, and will act on that and spearhead initiatives. So the critical mass doesn't exactly hold in representative politics. And so even a small number of women in a legislative body can make a difference, and the critical mass ratio doesn't really hold for women in elective office. So, to answer the question, to arrive at the result that I talked about at the beginning, that women's representation does affect women's policy options, I have to ask the question, what factors affect women's political representation? I think to nail that down. Real quickly, there's a few interesting regions to study what's happening on the state level. States remain important contexts in which to examine policy development and advocacy because, for a few reasons, there are executive powers enjoyed by state governors but not shared on the national level. There's the line item veto, so some policies can make it through in part and change, so state levels are very interesting. There are potentially longer terms of office for state-level executives compared to the national level. Only 7 of 50 state governors face absolute two-term limits, the way the president does. And governors have become more politically powerful over the course of the last several years because of devolution down to the state level from the federal level. So female governors, similar to female legislators, also act on behalf of policies for women and children. So another question I have to answer to get to the end point is what factors affect state policy innovation in the future? Because if I'm looking at women's representation and how that affects policy outcomes, and I don't account for all the other stuff that could explain it, then I could be wrong, right? So I'll show you what these models look like. So this is our research question. What does women's political representation affect policy innovation, passing policies intended for women and families on the state level? We did find yes, and used as a measure of state policies for women and families, the Center for American Progress report, and a gauge of women's representation from a measure from the Center for American Women Politics, Harvard University. And so the model is that policies for women as a dependent variable is a function of women's representation and then a whole bunch of other things that researchers have found to affect policy making. So if you don't put that in the model, then any one of those things could also be an explanation, and we don't know. If we just focus on women's representation, we have to hold constant for all the other explanations. So to measure policies for women, that dependent variable, the left-hand side variable, we use the Center for American Progress 2013 report, The State of Women in America, a 50-state analysis of how women are faring across the nation. I don't think that's up there. I think it's AmericanProgress.org is there. Oh, no, it's down in the corner here, the report. AmericanProgress.org, yeah, it's where you can find their report and a bunch of other great things. So what they did is they graded states from A to F, and using 36 different indicators in 3 categories: economic security, business and political leadership, and health policy. So here is a look in the 2013 grade in some of the categories under economic security, business and political leadership, and health policy. They standardized this to have 10 states as A, B, C, D, and F. So they're evenly distributed across. And Utah actually ranks 49th and was one of 10 states at the bottom of the list. You see in this table that Utah is very last, but that's just because I put them in alphabetical order. Utah is second to last. So that's the measure that I used for state policy grades, the thing we're trying to explain. The key independent variable is women's representation, and I used CAWC's gender parity index. That's a report from 2015, and their parity index ranges from 0 to 100. 50 indicates ideal representation, equality. Under 50 is underrepresentation, and greater than 50 indicates women's overrepresentation. And the indexes for each state are based on women's representation in a bunch of different areas. 3 years in gubernatorial elections, statewide elective office, House, Senate, gender of House speakers, number of female mayors in cities with population greater than 30,000, and county executives in the 5 largest counties. So those are the main measures. And again, here's the model with a little more detail. We're looking to explain policy grade over there on the left-hand side. And it doesn't show up as well as I'd like, but this is a nested model. So there are things that explain policy grade, and that's the gender parity index, women's representation, plus a bunch of other stuff. But in turn, women's representation has gauged by gender parity index to the function of other stuff. So it's a complex relationship, and the method that I use can account for this. So I'm controlling for all the other factors that explain women's representation, and all the other factors that explain policy grade to converge on a yes or no answer to our original question. So here is, this is the stripped down version of the model where I just have a catch-all category of other factors. This next slide has all of the details. And I'm going to go through it to spare your mind this morning. But these are all the variables that other researchers have found explain state policy grade, and these are all the other variables that researchers have found explain women's representation. So you see the text on the left-hand side here. This state policy grade is a function of gender parity index, and then in turn, the gender parity index is a function of all this other stuff. And you can run that, put it in. Oh, actually, before I get to that, I do want to show some interesting measures. So you'll see in the model the very independent variables that explain state policy grade. There are a couple of culture, state culture, political culture variables. And what I ended up using was the average of red-blue state grades in 2012. And the next few pictures that I'm going to show tell you, I think, a convincing reason why using red and blue for 2012 makes an argument for capturing state political culture. Okay, so this map just shows, see the legend there, the policy grades from A to F, just plotted on the map. Well, taking a look at this, it occurred to me, especially looking at Colorado and New Mexico, that it resembles someone. Keep in mind that this policy grade cap is used in 2013. So you see on the coast there, we've got West Coast and East Coast high grades, but then you see Colorado and New Mexico pop up, and then Illinois, of course, popping up in there. I thought, you know, I wonder how the Electoral College from 2012 map superimposed on this would look. So before we get to that, this next map is that Electoral College map from 2012. And it's kind of cool, right? So you see a little bit of the lower grades in the red states, again, mostly the higher grades on the coast. And then Colorado and Mexico pop up. This next one, again, is the Electoral College in 2012. And so, but why this matters is that the policy diffusion literature says that policy in a state is affected by its neighboring states and states that are so-called politically similar. And trying to get a capture on what means politically similar, well, was this, to look at this map and say, hey, I think we could maybe take not only the average grades of border states and see if that explains the own state grade, but then take the average of all red and blue and see if that helps explain as well. And so, kind of cool here is that this will be the basis, this mapping here is the basis for calculating the grades for quote unquote politically similar states. And I had my graduate studies team pull this apart, and you'll see that there were no 2012 blue states with D's or F's. And there were no 2012 red states with A's or B's. So the premise is that the Electoral College color, red or blue, in 2012 helps to explain the state policy grade in 2013. And again, visually I thought this was kind of cool to see how this broke out and that it hopefully could be a valid measure. Okay, so this next map is just the state, the very first map that you saw, grades A to F, and then what the number value is. And these I just used for grading scale from the university, frankly, where a 4.0 is an A and a 0.0 is an F, and then breaking out everywhere in between. I'll use this as you see for Utah, for instance, 50 border states grades are, what I do is get average border state grades, so 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 7, 3.7 plus 2.3 plus 3, and divided by 5 for that entry for Utah. So this side, the red and blue, is politically similar, and then this is the neighboring states. Now this next slide is a little different. This is just a neat visual of NCSL gauges state legislative led to a church as professionalized, most professionalized, the least professionalized in terms of how long the legislature meets, how are chapters paid and full time, and kind of no surprise that the larger states will have more full time, higher paid legislatures, and states out in the West, including Utah, have the need for as long, have more of a part time legislature. Okay, so that's just another variable that we use. So this whole slide is just really the senior, the theoretical base, all the other studies, at Atkinson and Carrillo 2007, Commissioner Rangel 2004, that's all the stuff, all the other papers that have been published that we use to say, okay, this is the variable that we want to include. Because the idea is you don't go decide these things on our own. You go to what's been published in the past to tell us whether something would be included or not. And then the last column in this table, the expected effect on Y, which is the state policy grade, does it increase or decrease? And what this tells us is what we would expect to see the coefficients after we run the model, whether those coefficients be positive or negative. Does it increase or does it decrease state policy rate? All right. So here's just some averages of a few variables. The state policy grade averages C, which makes sense because they evenly distributed over A through F. Average red state grade is lower than average blue state grade. And remember that these numbers are really just grades. B plus is 3.42, that's your grade point average, would that be a B plus, and a 0.83 would be a D minus. Remember that the parity index is 50 indicates parity, greater than 50 is overrepresentation of women, and under 50 is underrepresentation of women. And across the 50 states, the average parity index is 18.32. There's only one state that had greater than 50, and that was New Hampshire in 2015 when the parity indexes were calculated. On average, 24% of female legislators are female across the country. We see the other averages there that are just interesting to see across the 50 states. Okay, this next table shows us, okay, what are we really looking for here? What we're looking for is the top row in the table. What's the coefficient, that's the number, on gender parity index? Because all those other things in the first column that are bolded are all the other things that explain the amount of policies for women and families. This is all the stuff controlled for it, all the alternative explanations. What we want to see in our gender parity index, you see a 0.07 and then 3 asterisks. What that tells us is a couple things. It's positive, so that means gender parity index increases the state policy grade, and since state policy grade is measured from 0 to 4, remember F to A, positive means increasing. So as the parity index gets higher, the policy grade gets higher. And those 3 asterisks, if you go down to the bottom of the table, this, what that is telling us is that this result did not arrive by chance. It's not a spurious result. And we can be confident to say so at the, you see at the bottom of the table, the 1% level. So 99 times out of 100 that this model is run, we will get a robust result. We will get a non-spurious result. And that's a great finding. So what we can say with confidence is that this is that women's representation is based on gender parity index increases the policies for women and families in states, and that result is not found by chance.
Yay!
So,
all of this.
I know, this is the stuff, right? We want to say this stuff anecdotally, but what's necessary, at least I tell myself this for job security reasons, is that holding constant on this other stuff, running the statistics where I'm supposed to, we can make that statement, not just anecdotally, but with social science behind it. So, women's political representation does in fact affect women, policies for women and families at the state level. Specifically, an increase in women's representation increases or improves the policy landscape for women and families. Now, we can also say how much, and that's what that 0.07 number tells us. An increase in gender parity by one standard deviation, about 10 points, increasing your state grade by 0.7 points, and that's what that 0.07 tells us. So if I say 1 point, then it would be that 0.07, 10 points, which is very about a standard deviation, not huge. I'm not saying anything else. It has to change some outrageous amount. But one standard deviation increases that grade by 0.70 points from C to a B minus, which is great. So some of the groups working to change women's representation and policy innovation in Utah, women represent about 15% of the state legislature, and Utah has a number of organizations working to change that. The bills that I have listed in here are ones that the Utah Women's Coalition has tracked in their resource. We thank the YW, of course, is one of those working on behalf of change. All these organizations are familiar to all of you, too, with the Women's Leadership Institute, Elevate Her Challenge. Now, they're looking at both public and private sector to get increased women in all areas of leadership. I want to make sure I have the YW's policy alert. I can send this to you, Erin. I put that thing up there, right? So, yeah, so there are a lot of things that we can do to stay informed. You can also share your story on the healthpolicyproject.org. And, of course, tracking legislation, which I have in the next few slides on utahwomencoalition.org. Okay, so these next couple slides show just a selection of some of the bills under the different categories at Center for American Progress, that the economic security, leadership, and health policy. You've heard 2017 bills in each policy category, and their result, according to Women's Coalition. Did I get any of them wrong? No, this is just a selection. I said on the slide. There are a lot more. And again, this is just a selection of them that made up that I couldn't, make the slide completely unreadable. But there are a few that passed that Utah Women's Coalition backed, and then a couple that failed, that you all know this. Well, under leadership, there are probably more, but one that was pretty clearly a leadership issue. House 93 that failed, and then under health, again, this is just a selection of bills that there could have been a much bigger slide with more bills on it. But to have it readable here, again, you were very aware of the status of each of these, I'm sure. So, in conclusion, I used data from 50 states on women's political representation and found that representation, in fact, improves policy outcomes for women and families, where policies for women use that state grade from Center for American Progress, and women's representation is gauged by CAWD's Gender Parity Index. And again, that 10-point increase in the Gender Parity Index increases the state grade by more than half a point. And that model accounts for several other factors, in other words, controlling for a bunch of other things that affect policy outcomes. So we can say with confidence that this one thing, representation, holding all the other stuff constant, does affect women's policy. And, the state can increase its state policy grade a number of ways. Oh, I thought I had that slide now. Okay. Electing more women to political leadership positions at federal, state, and local levels, enacting bills to improve women's economic security, leadership, opportunities, and health, or do both. And as you know, there are several Utah organizations working to achieve both of those objectives. So I will end it there. Thank you for this opportunity to come speak before you. I will send you any of this information that you would like, and also my contact information is on this last slide, but I can give you my contact information as well, and I'm happy to talk. This is just one of the many projects I've got going on that I thought would be interesting to you. We have, I work with folks from the Hinckley Institute to put a press release together on this that's obviously more digestible than all of this, but I'm happy to answer your questions. I'm happy to speak on these issues and others in any context you'd like to have. So thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us today, and thanks for reaching out and letting us know this position. Precisely the type of stuff that we love to have people come present.
help feed our direction. In fact, we just had a public policy committee meeting last week, and we're trying to think of direction and how to synthesize what we see coming at us with so many different things that we could work on. And this is a very timely review of what the research shows us and, you know, what the policy levers are that we could start really manipulating and moving forward on. So glad to have the moving beyond the anecdotal and actually having the empirical information that shows us that we really, what we decide to do here and how we can guide that process will affect those changes that are made, and then moving forward and ensuring that we grow our numbers in the legislative, in our legislative cohort, and how that makes a difference too. Thought that was very interesting what you showed, Dr. Mastrassian, on the effects of states, neighboring states, on policies of a certain state. And can you drill down a little bit more in terms of maybe some more examples of that, in terms of, have you delved into direct policy? For example, let's say that a state that adopts FMLA, do you see that impact of that starts to creep into neighboring states? What shows that?
Now, that's not something I have studied directly myself, but I will say that. She said the literature does show that, and it's policy researchers that who have done specific innovation and diffusion research, do show consistently that diffusion comes in two ways. It's the politically similar and it's the neighboring states. So I don't know about FMLA specifically, a state level FMLA. But Medicaid expansion, follow that path. There are something I do know a little bit more about, the state minimum wages. You'll see that state minimum wage increases happened on the coast, popped up in Illinois. And then since then, so that would be more the politically similar argument, not route, than the neighboring state route. So those are two areas that I can speak with a little confidence about, but then certainly other researchers have done a ton of work on that. Neighboring states. Yeah, so that's principally, that's the second row in this table, coming from very 1990, and then everyone who's cited them since on specific policy areas. And then I have a site here for average state politically similar, which I use here to define red blue states, recipes. And then they, of course, come back to very as well. So the scholarship is pretty clear on the neighboring state effect and the politically similar effect. And if we're just kind of running out and seeing, you know, who specifically has done, like, there's a minimum wage research, the Medicaid expansion of MLA, EITC.
Right. That's what intrigued me. I think out of there's a variety of things that intrigued me about the research and what you put together here, but I'm really intrigued about the pathways to speak passage of certain policies based on the fact that a neighboring state may have something in place, almost even more so than politically similar, because that almost seems to be a given. I mean, you kind of follow, we found that up here, that if you want to present a piece of legislation, you don't talk about how it's passed in California, for example. So, you know, we try to find politically similar states that have run similar legislation when those of us are running legislation say, well, somebody like Montana or, you know, South Dakota has run legislation, or Oklahoma, Alabama, those are ones that we've used, have run legislation similar to mine, or it's not different in this group, and we try to shy away from those that are politically not similar. But it's really interesting to kind of see which neighbors, kind of look to which neighbors more so than politically similar, and how that would make a difference. And I think, especially within the Western region, where we have this idea of Western exceptionalism and the way we do things, also kind of plays a part into that. And I don't know whether there's literature, and I don't know whether that's more of a politically similar type of indicator, where it's just the culture, I guess is the best way to put it, culture of the state that drives political agenda and policy direction, and then that, how come that might overlay on top of all of this too, is kind of intriguing. that kind of, you see it a little bit here.
I think it's really both, right? I was in Illinois for 13 years, and Illinois paid attention to, New York had, for instance, a higher minimum wage. That, because I think it's a couple things. So if you make a decision in terms of your demographics and your policies, or I mean your politics, in that I know Illinois paid attention to what, say, New York was doing, or could be stained by something that happened in California, not just because they all happen to be blue states, but the urban centers there. So in Chicago, they would have this little brother issue with New York. And so New York has this excellent recycling program, and Chicago can't seem to figure one out. So using that as a comparison is focus on kind of demographics of the state. Urban areas are able to figure this issue out. Why can't we? And you see that also with the crime statistics. Why are the crime statistics in this urban area so much higher or lower than others? So there's that comparison, which gets at a little bit of the political similar, but it's definitely the demographic similar. And then in the West, here, it's politically similar and then geographically similar. So even though, say, you use Montana as an example, Montana's not a border state, but it's certainly politically similar.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a bit of that. So the geography defines some of that as well. And I agree that making the case that Montana passed X law or Y law is a stronger argument than to say Washington passed it.
Any other questions for the Thank you very much. It's really, really good information. I have a pragmatic question. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's doable or not, but it's fascinating to see, like you said, understanding the anecdotal, but then seeing the data that backs it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fascinated by the slide. I know there are a lot of women's organizations that are trying to make impact. And I think about, we need them all, and they're probably all working together, like we're working with WLI and various things, and I think from a stereotypical standpoint, women are typically more collaborative, and so I'm thinking through a pragmatic question of, because you have the data, and maybe it's the question, and maybe I'm using the wrong one, but is there a way based on either history of the percentage of women legislators, let's say for example in mayors and you know all of the count that you have for women representation, is there a way to get to a women's representation percentage, right, to be able to sort of inform all of these great organizations, for every one additional legislator you make, we can move our 49th rank up to 48th. Right? Is there a specific?
Well, this is a slide that I thought I had that I must have skipped over, but using what the Center for American Women in Progress, how they calculated their state gender parity index, I had the slide, but I must have just skipped over it. So we have our increasing the index by 10 points, that one standard deviation. There are five ways to get it at 10 points. So, electing a female governor, that's a plus 10. And again, this is according to that purple and yellow report from the Center for American Women in Politics. I used their math on this and just different scenarios that would increase us from what our number is. And I'm trying to go what grade of F that we have. We're trying to go after getting that up to a D.
Right.
So
did that mean, so
yeah,
10 points moves us from an F to a D minus? Or 10 points, how does that
happen? I have to look at what the grade is, and I don't have it right in front of me, but what our grade is, well, even if it's zero, you know, it's not zero, an increase of 0.7 gets us to a D, D plus,
yeah.
Which goes into the front.
So really, I mean, all of the organizations can get together and say, okay, who's the next additional without losing? So, right, replacing and then maybe it's two more, but I mean, really realistically saying, let's set a goal to really make us a pragmatic impact, right? That would be very interesting to align around a common goal to see an impact and measurably increase that, right?
Well, you can see here, this is on the local and state level and federal level, one female U.S. Senator, and one additional House representative, female House of Representatives member, two female senators, in the past, being Dina, there's an increase of 10 points. On the local level, the last bullet point here, four more female state chief centers, plus 15 more house reps, plus one more female mayor, again, without losing anything, gets us to 10 points.
I think this could be very relevant for the WLI.
Great.
Absolutely. But I would love to see even the commission maybe take on just as a message, perhaps, to say, you know, we would love to work with the other women's organizations to just do something so simple and pragmatic as to sort of take this curtain work to say, how can we help align toward the goal of, you know, two more female legislators or one mayor and one legislator.
So I know that we bumped our social terms in terms of, because we're now up to 19%. Because we got four more legislators, right? So we have three women in the House. Did you get one more senator this year, last year? No. So it was the three in the House that we added. So we jumped up from a little over 16 up to 19, right, Erin?
Didn't you get at least one female in the House?
No, because we were...
That was replaced.
Yeah, so we replaced Sophia DeCaro with Wade. So it was, you know, we... And then we got Lizen B. Watkins and I'm thinking one more person that joined us. I'm going blank. All I know is there are now more Republican women, and we held solid with our Democratic women, so we bumped up a little bit. But it did. But then it did move us from like 49th or 48th up a little bit higher on the chart. So even with just that little movement, we're closer to 20% than we were before.
And keep in mind that the gender parity index that I'm using here is 2013.
Is that what closest? No, that's fine.
Yeah, so the numbers now are going to be different. And I know a lot of organizations can make these grading shapes lists too, so it's the focus of this year. But yeah, based on their math and the rankings, I know they even have 2016 ranking up there, I think. These are the sorts of
recruiters and also that anyone have one more person that we joined this year that's house or was just a number of people.
I would love to see the commission. I mean, I know we don't do a lot of sort of contacting on the ground. But I've asked us, I'd love to reach out to women's organizations to say,
well, just to inform them that we can't do the policy work unless there's, you know, if we don't support the work that you're doing on this other side.
I think it would be interesting with the subcommittee, the multi subcommittee, to just sort of bear that in mind here.
It underpins the other discussions that we've been having in terms of the direction.
And how can we support their efforts? How can we be more involved or attend their events? Or, you know, what is it that we can do as a commission to help?
And something that's worth clarifying is the move away from the critical mass thinking of 30%. Saying that that's different for political women because they're elected for women and see that as a key role. That's not to say only a handful of women can become easier with more representation. So a handful of women working on behalf of issues for women and families can make a difference in a way that we don't see in cancer's corporate women, but there's nothing saying that that's easy. So that research isn't saying that, all we need is a couple of women and everything's fine. It's not saying that they're always effective, except they see themselves as definitely representing women's interests and not choosing to blend in with a corporate woman.
Very interesting. Well, thank you again. Are there any other questions before I thank Dr. Sashi for her information? I'm going to be horribly selfish at present and ask you to send this to me ASAP if you
would. Yes, no problem.
I'm actually going on a webinar in another hour and a half talking about women in legislative leadership. And we'll cite, if you don't mind, the site and with total attribution to your work. But there's some information here I'd like to be, since it's so current, to add some of that to my discussion. So,
I did do so.
And then send it to Shelley, and then Shelley can just shoot it out to everybody on the commission, even those that weren't here, because I know that they would absolutely love to see this information. It's very, very insightful and helps us understand that we're actually making a difference by some of the stuff that we're doing here, which is, it's sometimes good to kind of hear it from like a theoretical standpoint, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, and again, I'm happy to help the commission however I can, and this is one project of many that I've got.
We'll have to have you come back as you, please let us know as you finish the other projects and we'll have you report, definitely.
Great.
All right, super, thank you.
Okay. So moving on to next up, what's on next on the agenda, we have subcommittee update, and I'm going to turn over to Commissioner Robinson if you would mind. And we do have a matter of discussion that I just wanted to clarify based on some correspondence about the maps that I want to talk about too, but I'm going to go ahead and Commissioner Robinson, so just kind of let us know what's going on with the research committee.
Okay, thank you. So we received yesterday an email, and maybe you can address that from Susan Anson at UVU, talking about the work she's doing on demographics for each element. So it sounds like, do you mind if I
just... No, please.
Okay. Go for it. It sounds like she isn't going to be able to make the change, but they run into some problems getting access to data, and it's just been a little bit slower. So they'd like to push their deadline to the end of the year, so that'll be the end of December of this year. And I am certainly comfortable with that. I just think their work is so important and it would be so helpful to what we need to be doing and understanding that it's just on research for us to get it. The others, if you have it, incomplete information. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. The second thing is we, of course, released our report in February, the focus group study that was completed at our office. And the next step is to do a survey. And so I think the commission at the last meeting looked at seeking out additional funding, so we need to hear an update on that and see where we want to go with that. And then lastly, our office, the Gardner Policy Institute and the YWCA are talking about doing some child care research. Our office is doing more deliberative work, gathering people together to talk about issues, and we think child care would be a great one. So Erin and I are going to talk this week or next about seeking some additional funding for that. Whatever we do, we'll be glad to share it with the commission. So those are the three things we have.
So, Kathy, do you want to just report on your conversation with Dr. Madison so everybody's kind of clear where we are in terms of her question as to whether that can continue in what it was related to the contract that we have with UVU and her team?
Sure, happy to. So we did get $25,000 appropriated specifically for this research project. And typically when money is appropriated in one fiscal year, it needs to be spent within that fiscal year unless you get non-matching authority specifically for those funds. So since we're butting up against the end of a fiscal year, Susan reached out to me and shared her concerns that they wouldn't be able to invoice us for reimbursement for payments after the new fiscal year starts. So I checked with our finance department and we have enough non-matching authority just in general and our option policy line item for our agency, so we're just gonna piggyback off of that. And so I let her know yesterday that she can continue to invoice, send her invoice, and she'll be able to get her reimbursement into the fiscal year. So.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you finding a way to make that work. Because I was concerned about the non-matching authority, whether that, I doubted it tied specifically to that line item, so I'm glad that there's enough overarching authority within the department to be able to do that. So thank you for working with them. So she'll be able to go ahead and continue, and you said you communicated that to her, so she's set to go and continue to move forward on that. Alrighty. So one thing that I realized looking at the minutes is that Senator Escamilla and myself and Representative Edwards do have an assignment. From the last meeting, we talked about possibly visiting with Science Bank Senator about maybe seeing if maybe they could work on funding for the next step of the questionnaire, the more broader survey work that we want to do to augment the focus group work that was done. So you and I will get together and do that. So I had forgotten that, so my apologies on that. So let me go ahead and work with our other representative leaders and see what we can do there and continue to try to find some additional funding so we can continue that process. I've had the opportunity a couple of times to utilize the focus group research in just general discussions about what not only what the commission is doing, but what seems to be resonating in the world of women in the workforce and what are some of the stumbling blocks. I've used it as a STEM
anecdote that you talked about in terms of those conversations with women in rural communities in particular, because I often run into people who talk about STEM is great, let's just keep on working on STEM, and I should say it's great to have the offerings, but if people don't know how to access them or they have other barriers that prevent them from accessing them, especially in our rural communities, then we have to be able to meet those people where they're at, and if they can't go to a class because they have child care issues, there's just so many other underlying things that might be preventing them from, when they go out to the community and they face them and there's a blank look on the face of the people surrounding the table, there's something that we need to be doing better in terms of communicating those opportunities. So that was probably one of the most, was an epiphany for me in the findings from the research. I knew about child care, but the extent where you ran into that everywhere you went. So I'm glad that we're moving in that direction and that kind of going to the work that the policy committee is looking at doing, and that will move me into a discussion of our meeting that we had last Friday, and where we would like to, the direction that we're exploring to go as a committee, and recommendations that we want to bring to the commission's consideration. So we met. Members of our public policy committee include Commissioner Friedgang, and senators, myself, Representative Edwards, Stephanie Pitcher with the Women's Coalition, Paul Merrow, and Aaron Jensen from the YWCA presently, and we will include you, Commissioner, and I will make sure that you get notice on that also and for future meetings. During that meeting, we had an IGP update from Commissioner Friedgang, let me do this instead of speaking for you, Commissioner. I'll just let you do just kind of a brief synopsis of some of the things that we talked about what's happening with the strategic planning and next steps for IGP, and then we'll jump into basic. We went into a broader discussion generally before we want to go into the next preparing for the next legislative session. And in particular, context of what's happening federally and how that's going to impact what we have to work with appropriations-wise, how that will affect programs. There are a number of agencies and organizations and coalitions that are looking, that are scouting out, looking at what's in the environment moving forward and how that will affect policy and appropriations. And we think that that's kind of the next, that's triage that we may need to work on as a commission. But before we do that, Commissioner Friedgang, I want you to talk a little bit about IGP.
Yeah, and if it's okay with you, I'd like to turn it over to Commissioner Bonas, just because she's over seated.
I'm happy to maybe just I'll
go over to my son and then you guys can.
I'm happy to jump in. I just
think
it's more even than you asked, but I'm happy to talk about the county that I work for. So.
Oh, okay.
Just an update as to where we are at, because I know that the plans have just been put together and just barely submitted to you, and just kind of what is next step based on those plans. And I know that Senator Escamilla had some questions related to funding to actually implement what we've got in those plans and what we might need to look forward to, as well as missing populations that aren't affected by the target, the IGP targets, and what we might be able to do to cascade the benefits of those plans going forward.
Sure, I'll just talk to the timeline if that works for you.
Sure.
In terms of the email that came out from Tracy Gruber, and then you can maybe talk to the funding people.
Okay.
So the 13 counties that were selected turned in state plans to the Department of Workforce Services last Friday. And so the Lieutenant Governor Cox and his intergenerational welfare commission will be looking at all of the plans and then looking at the patterns. And then in their next committee meeting, we'll be talking about what the similar trends are and probably some of the outlining, if there are outlier issues with the various counties. And so they'll be reporting out at their next commission meeting on where the state plans are. And then as we were looking at this coming up year, identifying more counties to, once they start this pathway with the original 13, really looking at how to take more counties and work with more counties on their intergenerational populations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's perfect. Mm-hmm. I think they're meeting in, what is it, June
17.
But yeah, that's exactly the timeline. As far as funding, you know, we, these specific rural counties that we've been working with, we offered them a $15,000 grant so that they could develop their own plans at the county level, the community, at the local level. But we've been pretty firm and straightforward that's it. And that we don't have, you know, buckets full of money to then help them implement their plan. But I think the goal is to, you know, help strategize on ways in which they can re-raise their own funding at the local level. Maybe they can approach different nonprofit organizations to help. So we're definitely involved in that to figure out creative ways in which to implement their plans. I don't know, I would turn to you, Representative, on if there's a case for funding at the state level. So right now we're really just asking for the local entities to come up with their plan and how they think they can best implement it and fund it.
July 12th is when the
commission
meets to decide. And so I think it'd be interesting to have maybe one of the commissioners from the International Poverty Commission be come to present to the microphone and meet on. That might be an interesting conversation or dialogue.
I think she's always presented at least once a year.
Yeah, so this was the reason that we had her present during the session, I think, right at our February meeting at the beginning of the year.
I think that was on the annual report. It would be awesome to see what all the various counties are doing and what the findings are from the county now.
I think what I'd be really interested in is the trends that are starting to tease out from all of the several counties, because that allows us to zero in on and focus on lower hanging fruit, or what it seems to be the big, if there's a commonality amongst the number of the counties and there are limited funds or there's no funds, but then we can also, then we can say, okay, we're realizing there's a trend line of whatever was out there or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. That's why we would like as a commission to join in on that and then look to what the environment's looking like federal-wise, where we'll be short, where those gaps will be, and just really find a way as a commission and say, you know, there, and I think this is one thing that Senator Escamilla brought up during our public policy committee, of finding one or two things that we can get a variety of different stakeholders, including the chambers of commerce, you know, the corporate community, everybody to say, we can't make a difference on every single thing, but if we could look at health for children, and childcare maybe as two major things we want to work on. Mm-hmm. And just say those are we're just gonna pick a couple and just put all of our political capital into these things and move them, you know, this is gonna be what the commission is working on and working with the different coalition groups. But that might be when we see the trends from those strategic plans of those counties saying, you know, time and time again, this is the one thing people are saying, whether it's training, whether it's childcare, we'll just see. So I think that's what I would be versus just a general report from IGP as you see those trends coming through and percolating up on the review of the plans, Commissioner Bonas and Commissioner Brandon and Andy that are working with IGP, and I'll mention this with Representative Edwards. Let's see what's percolating to the top, because as is often the case, there's a lot of competition for policy direction as well as funding, and we're going to have to make the best that we can with it. What we can access, so let's keep an eye on what you're seeing as that moves forward in our next public policy committee.
And then the other question that you brought up at the policy meeting was, and I don't know this piece of it, but you guys had mentioned that there was $1 million legislated in this session for allocation.
Every year. For the base for the IGP?
Was that? I thought how much can we allocate for the intergenerational poverty program?
Nothing. We didn't ask for any money to address LGBT.
Ever?
Oh, not
for the
I didn't know that.
I mean, how is intergenerational poverty working right now? funding line.
Just rely on all internal funding sources.
I thought there was a for the grants. How does that money come from?
That was from the Buchanan.
Oh, okay, so there is funding. That's the Tanner funding, right? And then there's nothing. I mean, all of it is Tanner.
That's all we've spent was the $15,000 we spent in rural counties. That's all that's been spent on intergenerational poverty from the DWS side.
Okay. And
we haven't implemented any...
any program.
Right.
So all the grants are TANF grants?
Yes. So like, for example, the after school program, are you speaking maybe to the after school program and all those things that happened previously? That's kind of funding.
Oh, I got it. How much
so anything associated with IGP,
yeah,
exclusive of the grant program, and administrative costs for the commission itself, we're just trying to get a handle of where we've been able to get some funding streams to utilize for some of the programs.
Yeah. So I'm thinking that the fund, I mean, there's multiple funding streams, like the Simonti School is the special assistance grant, so it's not TANF necessarily. So what I hear is that there's multiple funding streams through the regular channels on things that could be related to IGP, but maybe right, not specific.
No, there's, remember when we were working on my after school program?
Uh-huh.
So there is funding from TANF just for intergenerational poverty. So those are the ones that have to go to San Juan County, correct?
Right, so I
did. There is funding, just for IGP. Because I couldn't tap that funding on my bill because my bill does not discriminate against immigrants and refugees, which the IGP, you know, definition does,
mm-hmm,
which is my problem with the definition. So
right,
there is funding that you can only tap for IGP. They were designed based on TANF, and I've had meetings with, you know, the staff of DWS, of the after school and daycare,
mm-hmm,
and all this. So there is funding just for IGP definition that is mostly going through TANF for all these different programs where they're targeting mostly San Juan County, you know, like the rural areas with Native Americans, mm-hmm, because they have the data to prove that there is intergenerational poverty. So, I mean, those were the, I don't know how much it is now, I don't know if it was from the $60 million that we're helping.
So we're trying to figure out,
we were trying to figure out funding-wise. I mean, we can ask our fiscal analyst office. They know, because we were looking into that funding to fund. You know, we're not experts on all the budgets, but we can, like, see whatever our issues are, and our fiscal analyst office, and that's when I was clarifying. Like, yeah, the reason why this clarify, you know, this only applies to this specific areas, or why the numbers are so high, for example, in San Juan County, is because it's mostly Native Americans, but you do have all the data related to intergenerational poverty that you can find on refugee or immigrant families.
Yeah.
And that's what everything kind of like was clear. I have, this is 2-3 years ago, so I don't know how many, if the funding continues based on TANF, because it's all part of that $60 million that may be completely gone already, you know, the money that was lost. So it's gone. So yeah, I mean, so that's what we're talking about as public policy subcommittee, is like, what do we need to tackle based on funding appropriations? And if that money's gone, then what does that mean? And I'll tell you why, because, like, you know, if we keep having these conversations about policy, and you have an administration that's now going to get rid, and by that I mean the federal government, getting rid of all the funding for those programs, I mean, we can kick the by any new policy, but even we're going to have to go in a reactionary mode and start defending what we know is basically barely working,
mm-hmm,
and before we start creating this stuff. So like, that's what we were trying to figure out. And I said, look, I looked at that 3 years ago. The funding may be completely gone for all I know.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we've been, you know, getting rid of it. I mean, using those 10 or 16 million, which is probably done that, you're right.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I figured it was nothing from the state. I thought that when Representative Senator Reed, Stuart Reed, passed this bill, there was an appropriation attached to it, but this is 2011. So I don't know if that was disappeared or it never happened. So it was just.
Yeah, it never happened.
So it was just a pattern of money, but
yeah,
they were going to do a lot.
It's not federal funds that can be interpreted to.
Yeah, do a lot of that. Yeah, and the problem is now, on the situation we're facing, we may not have any federal money either. So that's what we were talking about, our policy appropriation, but our focus may be defending programs that help.
Yeah.
And how do we find state money? The feds are completely going to be gone from the picture.
Yeah.
And that's something we haven't faced as a state ever.
Yeah.
As much as my colleagues like to, you know,
crowds up there, and be like, yeah, you know, we all hate FERC. Mm-hmm. We hate FERC, but we use all the money anyway, so the hypocrisy there. But, I mean, now we may not have money, so like now we're in a sort of different place. So there are the conversations, so thank you for clarifying that we have nothing now, and we need to start thinking, what do we do? And that's where we had the conversation of bringing the business community. Because mm-hmm. I think the business community will have a huge impact. When you don't have school programs or childcare, you know, quality childcare, what are they going to do with their workers?
Right.
And I was visiting a business in Utah County last week, and his answer is with a 2% unemployment rate, whatever that means, right? I mean, we can discuss what that means. At the end of the day, I still don't have workers.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm like, well, maybe you're not going to have any workers if there's no after school programs, because I, you know, hardly, I mean, even the need. Sometimes we choose not to, you know, I mean, they choose to stay home because their children may be at risk, right? I mean, this is a welcome kids as well. So, I mean, that's what we're trying to connect so we can go over the chamber and have a conversation with them. But no, this is helpful. I mean, we were like, this is good for Kathy to answer. But the news is, Kathy, giving them the news that there's no money, it would not be news. Thanks, Kathy.
You're welcome.
Yeah, this is the perfect one to give us our money.
Yeah,
well, I think that was what we were talking about.
Yeah.
So, Lisa, there's a couple of other things we thought about in the context of pulling this together under, or grappling with or grasping one or two priority areas to work on as both policy letters and keeping an eye on appropriations so that state funding is secured and protected or augmented based on the fact of whatever happens with the federal budget. The other thing that we've talked about, especially in line with this conversation about bringing other stakeholders, corporations, the chambers, the churches, the faith community into these discussions, is possibly looking at something like the Utah Contact that was established back when we were, grappling with the issue of immigration reform, and we were seeing neighboring states take very draconian measures against their immigrant populations. Utah kind of set forward, and a variety of stakeholders got together and said, these are the things that we believe in, and things that we do are driven by these standards or these principles that we believe in. So what the policy committee would like to recommend to the commission as our work moving forward is not only identifying and doing some triage work as to what things we need to protect first and foremost in order to carry forward our mission, but also to reach out to those stakeholders to say, can you join with us to establish a compact, we'll call it something else, but something that is the community standard or these are the standards that we believe in related to women and families and their ability to care for self-reliance, blah, 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 something along those lines. And these are elements need to be part of it. You know, people need to be able to, those children need to be able to have health care. You know, women need to be able to access opportunities to achieve their full potential, whether it's through training or education or whatever. Just kind of look at those things and then somehow align it with where we see things going with appropriations, what might be happening with the federal budget. So that's what we were considering, and just wanted to put that out for any input from other commissioners. Do you think we're moving in a good direction doing that? And take it from there. So any input on that or any concerns? Some of the other things we looked at is, doing it by our spheres and trying to remember our spheres. I finally found my talking points on the guiding principles of, this is what they were, income and property, families, education, and employment and workforce. And they're very similar to what we came up with when we were trying to kind of remind ourselves of it, which were health, education, employment, and safety. And I think we can kind of push on each of those. Income and poverty, families, education, employment, and workforce. And so kind of using those fears to really separate the policy levers that we're going to work on and somehow identify bills that might be already moving forward during the engine process and kind of pull them into those categorically. So we'll work on that too. Senator, can you want to talk a little bit about your white wage bill and some of the work that you're doing there? And that's another piece of legislation that we may want to prioritize moving forward.
Yes, thank you. Chairwoman, I filed a grant for that SB221. So that was a wage equity bill for state government. and could, you know, it will be drafted, which is the same. I do want to meet again with DHIN just to check, and then last time it was, I mean, basically what it does is just gather data at this point. I mean, it's doing a very, you know, data-driven analysis and, you know, just getting to the very specific, which was something that they couldn't do under the short version that they provided, that I think I'll share with you guys based on my request. So there is some cost attached. I mean, the last time they were willing to cover the cost. I'm not sure where they're going to be this time. But it will be nice if we just make it happen. It will. It also includes a strategic planning for the state agency if there's any disparities or gaps that are clear. We're giving up. The bill is very, very broad, and I think it was, you know, I didn't touch points because I get their concern. It's so hard to compare oranges and apples, and there's so many factors that could be, that could impact someone's wages, and that's the tricky part of this conversation, right? I mean, we understand that being a challenge, so we're hoping the bill will be in place, and maybe we don't need a bill. I mean, maybe my goal is just, we're going to be presenting the interim. When I think we made my bill and Representative Edwards' bill. So we made it, we put it in executive report, it meant for the management. I added my bill, because mine was uniquely discriminated in that process. So they were kind enough to see the precedent, realize that, you know, why not have the same, and he supported my motion. And so we got knowledge back on interim for conversation. But I don't know how the legislature feels, even if it's a study. I mean, I'll be very blunt. So I'm hoping maybe the executive branch will just take it as part of their own research, and they may do it. So that's another approach. It will be nice to have the Women in the Economy Commission support the concept of gathering that data as a purpose of just knowing where the state is. It's hard to go to the private sector and lecture them when the state has money to gather their own data, and so they know where they stand. So I'm not sure where Officer Andrew's bill will go either. It was not very well received. Yeah, at least mine made it out of committee. So that's, and his bill is more complicated. It deals with the private sector, so it's a little bit of a different field. But I'm hoping, if anything, our bill. So if the bill, I mean, if I cannot work it through the governor's office and then, you know, take it in the bill, but it's going to be tough. So the more we can, you know, articulate the importance of this issue and how it's hard to even have a conversation that takes stance when we don't have the numbers. And the state should be the one on the forefront, I think, teaching and, you know, giving some ideas on how to do it. So that would be nice to get that support.
Okay. Well, keep on keeping on, and we'll just keep it in the, you know, we'll work on it here,
yeah.
And then as we move forward into the fall. In fact, when do you anticipate presenting a bill or a solution? Well, just keep us posted. So
yeah,
if it's important, we're not a position.
In October, what we're aiming, the reason I'm asking is if I want to meet with the governor's office, and we are his commission in a way, maybe we want a position for that.
Yeah. Because I was just thinking, I was trying to think of when our next meeting is. I believe we had this week August because of NCSL, but I think we do have one in August. And then it would be because we alternate, so June, August, and then October. So
maybe August, if we can have, if you know, right now we're saying please review SB221 to the same language.
Yeah.
Then we can take a position on August, so I can go to the governor's office.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, announcement.
So with the Public Policy Committee, again, identifying two or three levers, looking at appropriations and commissioner, also if you could let us know if you're seeing any areas of concern in federal funding that may need to be augmented or matches increased by the state so that we can get ahead of it and help the division, I mean, the department work forward on supporting you on those as we are meeting more frequently with our appropriations committees. This interim is a lot different in terms of the legislative practice than we've had in the past, where usually the appropriations committees were held as needed, maybe two or three during the session.
this year, or the interim period this year, they're intentionally we're alternating. So we'll have a policy committee 1 month, then appropriations committee the next month, then policy committee the following month, and appropriations committee. So we're going to have more time, I think, to really dig deep in their appropriations. And so I don't want to be lost on my colleagues, in particular in social services, but also I would push that out towards anybody that serves. Do you serve on anything? Which committees do you serve on other than, you just sit with me in social services,
yes,
right?
Yes, 7-1.
Okay.
You're in social services.
That's it. Okay, so we'll have to figure out who, whether Deidre or, I think Becky is on the, she might be on the one that aligns with economic development. No, she's on social services with us. So she's down, Deidre's over there. So we're, and so Deidre isn't anymore. So we'll have to think of where she's at. But it's nice to have legislators that are on the various committees, and now we're kind of heavy on the social services, which is fine in terms of DWS, but for some of the other committees that also impact our funding streams, we don't really have representation from our legislative members that are on this commission. Another thing, too, is Commissioner Freeman brought up the fact that we have a number of groups that are starting to meet. I'm trying to remember the name of the group that Gina Cornea kind of leads with the, you said the Thunder, it's kind of this, what, I can't remember what it's called. Do you remember what it's called?
It's called
we just call it our advocacy meeting. So there's a, but there are a group of various advocates that represent various stakeholders and agencies that work with populations that receive TANF and SNAP and some of these other programs that meet with regularity, and they too are very concerned about what's happening on the federal front. So what we're going to do is start having those groups, representatives from those groups, or as the coalition itself, come and visit with us in August. I'm going to have Gina come and do a presentation on what they see and where they could seek our help. Again, trying to align directions of various stakeholders out in the community that are working on common interests, and so that we can kind of get on the same page and work as a coalition. Because I think on a lot of these issues, we've got to come out with united front and not have a splinter. And unfortunately, when we're looking at possible reduction in support appropriations wise from the federal government, people sometimes go into their separate corners and get very territorial. And rightly so, you protect your, what you got, and I did that. But if we can try to find those areas of commonality so we're coming out with the United Voices, one of the things we're looking at, well, we need to see what they're seeing. They're the experts in terms of working with the people, clientele, and customers. So I want to get their feedback as to where they think we need to be focusing our energy. So we'll do that in August. And then also talking about not only just the chambers and some of the more formalized groups that work with the business community, but reaching out to women CEOs and women leaders in the community, and maybe starting to have a discussion with them. So we'll reach out to the WLI and other groups that already have networks of women that might be there to address it as a, is an economic interest. I mean, if you've got employees, if you've got churning going through your workforce because of, you know, women that work for you that have to leave their jobs for one reason or another, and you're doing a lot of recruitment and retraining because of this churning, that is something that we want to bring those women CEOs and women business leaders into them. And maybe Commissioner Leonardi, you can help us with that, kind of that direction of maybe a convenient roundtable discussion with maybe some women CEOs about them. Have them help be influencers as we start to take this agenda forward for policy development. So that's what we're thinking of from the policy subcommittee. Sorry for the long report, but it's been a while since we've met, and we've got a lot done and a lot of discussion going on last week. So communications, as I mentioned earlier, Commissioner Wallace is on the committee leave, and so we'll have to check on with her to see where things are at. Is there anybody else that's on that committee? Commissioner Robinson, I'm not thinking that you were.
Yeah.
To get us an update on things.
Thank you. I don't have a great update. Really, I just want to impress on our group that we have got to improve our communication out of this office of this team. We, our website is the DWS website, and it's really like 20 years old looking, right? With style. And we have this template from,
it is, right?
But we have this template that's been sitting there for
a year.
Yeah, a year. And it's really disappointing to me that we haven't got that much. It has to be such a key component of branding, who we are, what we do, sharing good information. I think we're stifled in what we're able to do because we don't have a good presence.
So I think what I'd like to do, and I tried to do this before, that I'm going to send the tentacles out and the messaging out to all of you. You know, I think the private child is more traditional law, which is kind of during this honor up. And we've had some really great help with the IT people that have put the template together, but I think it's an issue of bandwidth. And so if anybody's interested in serving on that subcommittee, or if you know of people that have some really great skill sets that might be interested, you don't have to be a commissioner to sit on the subcommittees. So Ken, if you know of people that might be willing to help her out, I think that it's just an issue of bandwidth and her running this on her own. So think about people in your spheres that might be interested in serving on the communications subcommittee. So expertise with social media, expertise with, you know, media relations, marketing, branding, all of those kinds of things. And then let's get her some assistance so she's not trying to push that forward and trying to get us to respond to her and whatnot on her own. So, but I totally agree with you. Especially in light of the report, that you have to kind of pull that into the website and then cascade that out. We have such great opportunities to really show what we're doing and emphasize the relevancy. So, thank you.
The website is actually sitting there. It's just kind of this hidden website.
So, okay. You just need to push it out?
We just need to get that launched.
Okay.
Honestly.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So is it because we haven't voted on it as a mission, or?
I don't know.
Okay. Okay.
It's IT, that handles this, right, for the state, and
okay. It's
really sitting there, like all of your pictures are there.
Okay.
The data's there, the report's there.
So what we need to do is, we'll need to have Commissioner Lainhardy send a bio and a photo to, so send it to Commissioner Robinson. That way we can add to it and we'll help everybody up.
And even though I am a liaison commissioner, if you guys are comfortable, I would love to just have me get on the phone and say, well,
go for it. Well, I'm saying go for it.
Okay. Let's get it done.
When I was, I'm not necessarily on the subcommittee, but I attended some of the meetings, and it is pretty much ready to go. One of the conversations, though, was how to maintain it. How do you get the right information up there that you don't have to do a lot of changing out, but then, you know, do you link to maybe Dr. Madsen's emails or, you know, those sort of things? I'm wondering if potentially we could find some interns at the University of Utah to maybe do, especially even female interns, to come and to be part of the select committee and then help Commissioner keep it updated. And maybe that might be a way to make it sustainable.
And then maybe what I'll do is, we tried to, you know, I wanted to get some funding a year or so ago. The money that we used for the research project was going to be used both for the research and just a small stipend for an intern, but we needed all of it for the research, so we put it in for the research project with Dr. Madsen's efforts. So maybe what I'll do is, if I could just get a small pocket of money for a stipend for a student to help us with that communication effort going forward, because I just think that's what it needs, is just somebody really keeping, being able to do that. But in the meantime, I don't like that holding us up. So let's just launch it.
And I
have the ability to do that.
But you don't necessarily need a paid internship. There's probably multiple students who would want it as an actual
great
project.
Well, I think we need to move in that direction regardless, but I think principally as the commission, women of commission, the commission on women in the economy, that it says something if we say that we value the contribution in a manner that at least we want to be able to provide a stipend. So I think we should be able to help. We'll make it work. We'll find a way. So, alrighty. So I'm trying to remember when we decided to have our next August meeting, and if we adjusted it because of the fact that that at least the legislative members were going to be gone the second Tuesday. Did we do it on the 15th?
On the 1st.
On the 1st. Okay, good. So now I know. Thank you. I knew that we had tweaked it. Great. So our next commission meeting is August the 1st. From 10 to 12, just reminding all of you as commissioners that that's when it is. And if there are no other business, I'm just opening it up for open mic if people have anything else, any other business or to present to them. Open mic.
That sounds like an invitation.
Yes, it is. All right, seeing that, then I will myself make a motion to adjourn the meeting, and if there are I'm putting that motion forward. All in favor of adjourning the meeting?
Aye.
we adjourn. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Shelly. We have you here.